Yeah, it's really a great pleasure to be able to introduce Seamus Davis. Seamus Davis is currently a professor of physics at University of Oxford and University College Cork, and also a professor emeritus at Cornell University. And so Seamus is truly a world-leading experimentalist in the field of scanning tunneling microscopy. His group has done amazing experiments on all sorts of materials, ranging from high temperature superconductors to topological insulators and much more beyond that. So for all this great work, he's been recognized in many by many prizes, including the London Prize, Kamerling Onnes Prize, and most recently the Buckley Prize from the American Physical Society. So a big congrats to that, Seamus, and we're really
Thanks.
looking forward to hearing this talk.
Okay, great. Are we good to go? All right. Hi, everyone. If you can see my screen, I'm coming to you from the dreaming spires of Oxford. It's a bit darker than this right now, but otherwise, this is where we are. This evening for me and this afternoon for you. So I want to discuss, excuse me, I need to change mode here. Okay, hold on. Okay. Good. So I want to discuss the electron pairing mechanism of copper oxide high temperature superconductivity. So this is an old problem, but it's a very profound problem. And it has taken, I think, many thousands of person years to try to understand this fundamental piece of physics. And we recently have made a small advance in that regard. And that's the purpose of this presentation. Okay, so let me remind you. So if you have a large number of identical particles non-interacting with each other and their bosons, then if you cool down, so the vertical scale there is the energy scale of the eigenstates. At high temperature, you occupy many states, but eventually, if you cool down low enough, all the particles will fall into the same macroscopic quantum state. That's Bose condensation. Many of the younger people in the audience might think that Bose condensation was discovered in the 1990s by laser cooling, but that's false. Jack Allen discovered it in 1938. He was from Manitoba. And while he was at the Cavendish, he succeeded in condensing helium-4 into the superfluid state. And Fritz London identified that as Bose condensation. So in any case, you can make a macroscopic quantum state by forcing all the particles into the same quantum mechanical eigenstate. So one might guess that for fermions, that's not possible because only one fermion can identify each quantum mechanical eigenstate of a system. However, Mother Nature is very clever. And eventually, if you cool fermions enough, they pair. And pairs of fermions are bosons, and the bosons can condense into the famous BCS state. So in both cases, you end up with a system with a quantum mechanical wave function. It's got an amplitude and a quantum phase, but it's macroscopic. It can be as big as a house in some cases. And so the idea that, quantum mechanics is hidden from us at the atomic scale is completely false. There are many, many situations where it's available to us at macroscopic scale. So many of the elements in our universe, when condensed into crystalline materials, make superconductors, and those are zero resistance, infinite conductivity, perfectly dissipationless materials. And in fact, they now play a very important role in many of our, they're not economically important yet, but in terms of science, superconductors are extremely important. We use them for high magnetic fields, for medicine. We use them for quantum sensors. many of our most advanced telescopes now use superconducting sensors, either single photon or transition edge. The next generation of accelerators are going to use superconducting injectors and very high magnetic fields. We use high fields for a very wide variety of research, and now compact fusion reactors are being developed based on high TC superconductivity. But as everyone knows, the most exciting and important thing is superconducting quantum computing. So although now it's just at the edge of economic relevance, I believe, and I think many people believe, that in the next several decades, superconductivity is going to come to the fore, economically speaking. Okay. So now let's talk about the microscopic cause. So superconductivity is based on the pairing of electrons. So you end up with a quantum mechanical wave function describing two particles. It can be written as a product state of the real space part and the spin part. The spin part can either be singlet, total spin zero, or triplet. We're not going to discuss triplets today. And spatial component can be written, you can Fourier transform the spatial structure of the wave function in this form and then convert it into operator representation if you like that. But strategically, what happens is those electron pairs condense into a single macroscopic quantum state, lowering the total energy of the system, for which the expectation value of creation operator of spin up, creation operator of spin down, the combination is not zero. So normally that's an anomalous average, but for a superconductor, that average, in fact, virtually all the particles in a superconducting metal fall into that state. When that happens, you end up with a macroscopic quantum state. It's got an amplitude, it's got a quantum phase. The density of those pairs goes as the amplitude of the wave function squared, like anything in quantum mechanics, and there's a macroscopic quantum phase. Okay. Now, these are strategic facts about any kind of a fermionic superconductor. But now let's talk specifically about BCS theory. So Leon Cooper showed that you can pair electrons by having electrons of opposite momentum and opposite spin interact through some bosonic field, which originally was the phonon field. And if you sum over all possible interactions, you do end up with a macroscopic quantum state. It's a very subtle one, but nevertheless, it does depend on the occupancy of condensed fermions of spin up and spin down of opposite momentum. Details of BCS theory: you define an energy gap. It's a sum over the interaction potential in a Feynman-esque sense over this average of this anomalous average of particles of opposite momentum, opposite spin condensed. Then BCS found an equation. It's a self-consistent equation between this function, the energy gap, and itself in the presence of the interaction potential. If you can solve that equation, then you end up with a BCS superconductor. And we've understood that since the late 1950s. And in a way, that has become to dominate our thinking, not necessarily in the most healthy way, because in general, the requirement for superconductivity is not BCS theory, Bardeen, Cooper, Schrieffer theory. It's that the anomalous average of particles, of pairs of particles condensed, is not zero. And there can be many other ways that could happen besides BCS theory. And that's what we're going to talk about today. All right, now let's talk about cuprates. So starting in the mid 1980s, when I was starting in graduate school, the critical temperature of superconductors started to shoot up from a few tens of Kelvin up to 165 Kelvin at that time. And since that time, there have been other families of superconductors which have been discovered, the iron-based superconductors. But still today, At ambient pressures, the highest temperature superconducting materials we have available are still the copper-based superconductors. And the whole challenge has been to understand what is the cause of superconductivity in those materials. Well, we know for certain from a variety of experiments that it's due to electron pairing. So the real issue isn't, why are these compounds superconducting? The real issue is, how can you pair electrons at such extremely high temperatures and energies that they continue to superconduct up to about minus 100 degrees centigrade? Okay, now let's talk about CO2. In each compound, there's a plane of copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, a square lattice of coppers and oxygens. Looks very innocent. Each copper is in a 3D9 state, a single, so it's ionized. So there's a single electron in, or if you like, there's one hole in the D shell of the copper atom. And each oxygen is in a closed shell 2P6 state. And under those circumstances, it's an insulator, it's a Mott insulator. And to turn it into a superconductor, you have to remove some of the electrons from the copper or from the compound. And you do that by hole doping. So if we convert this cartoon into a band structure picture, there's a 3D9 band at low energies. Then to doubly occupy that D state of the copper atom takes a very large Coulomb energy, U. So the 3D10 state is about 3 electron volts higher in energy. Now, the overlap integrals between copper and oxygen are very strong, so the hopping rate is really quite high, if hopping were possible. But it's not possible under these circumstances because of Coulomb blocking of the motion. And okay, that's an insulator. So how do you turn it into a superconductor? Well, you dope it with holes. Doping with holes in this compound, since the chemical potential is at the top of the oxygen band, doping with holes means you remove an electron from one of the oxygen atoms. So when you do that, you make a new quantum mechanical state, which some people think they understand, but at least I don't understand. It's a mysterious state. But when you remove that electron from the oxygen atom, let's say from 10% of the oxygen atoms, then you end up with a new phase diagram. So vertical axis is temperature. Horizontal axis is the number of electrons you have removed per unit cell, the whole density. Even removing 1 or 2% of the electrons from the oxygen atoms destroys the insulating state and produces an unidentified state called the pseudogap state. It should be called electronic dark matter, but unfortunately it was misnamed. And we still don't know what this state is. But by the time you introduce, say, 15 to 20% of holes, then you end up with a high-temperature superconductor. Why does this happen? That's the outstanding question. Okay, now I want to remind you about super exchange. So just consider two copper atoms adjacent to each other with one oxygen atom in between. That's the elementary object in the plane of the CO2 plane. And as I said, the coppers are in the 3D9 state and the oxygens are in the 2P6 state. Now, the energetic structure of that three-atom object is shown here on the upper right. So you have the 3D9 state with one electron. If you were to introduce another electron to the copper atom, you'd end up in the 3D10 state, which is a much higher energy. And there's two electrons in the sigma orbital of 2P6, so it's pretty passive. And the other copper, similarly, if you would introduce another electron, you'd end up in the high energy 3D10 state. So you can write a Hamiltonian just for those three atoms, which looks like what's written here. Sum over energies for the D state, the D state of the copper atom, the P state of the oxygen atom, the hopping rate from copper to oxygen, which is the key thing, and the energy splitting between the 3D9 and the 3D10 state, which is U, shown on the right-hand side. If you just take three atoms, that's a solvable problem, at least in, with modern numerical techniques, it's a completely solvable problem. But you have to think about it carefully. So if you just take two coppers and one oxygen, there's one spin down in one copper. There's one spin up, I'll show you why, in the other copper. And there's two spin halves in the 2p6 state. So that's one conformation, and adjacent is another conformation. Now, if one electron hops from the oxygen atom to the copper atom, now a very strange thing happens, because the 3d10 state of the copper atom is at a much higher energy. You end up with a different conformation. And similarly, if the electron hops in the other direction, you end up with a new conformation. There's four ways that that can happen in the middle row. And in fact, if two electrons hop, one from copper to oxygen and one from oxygen to copper, you end up, there's two ways that that can happen. But the bottom line here is that the eigenstates are a function of the conformation of where the electrons are. And, you know, there's no, well, at present, we have no analytic way of solving a problem like that, right? We don't know what the eigenstates are because they're a function of the conformation of the system. Okay. Now, that's just for three atoms. Yeah.
Seamus, there's a question from Anna. Do you want to go ahead?
Sorry. That was an accidental raised hand. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
A question would have been good, though. Okay, fine. So if you solve this problem just for three atoms, which was solved by perturbation theory in the 1950s and can be solved accurately now, what you find out is that the spin half of the two coppers perceives a very strong Heisenberg-like exchange interaction between their spins, spin on the first and second copper atom. And the strength of that interaction, here's the key thing. The strength of that interaction goes as the hopping rate to the power of 4, because it takes two hops, 1 over the Coulomb double occupancy energy on the 3d9 state. And here's the key thing. It goes as 1 over twice the energy splitting between the 2p6 state and the 3d10 state. And that splitting is called the charge transfer energy. That's the core quantum mechanical object in this class of theory of CuO2. And now if you take the limit where the Coulomb energy is much, so the energy between the two copper configurations is much bigger than the energy between the 2p6 and the upper copper configuration, then the Heisenberg exchange interaction goes as 4, hopping rate to the power of 4, charge transfer energy, that's what this energy is called, epsilon, charge transfer energy cubed. That was already known in the 1950s, mostly for transition metal oxide insulators. All right. So here's a summary of that situation. Take two coppers, put an oxygen in between, ionize the two coppers, close the p-shell of the oxygen. Then there should be a very powerful exchange interaction between the two copper 3d9 spins. And the magnitude of that interaction should be 4, hopping rate to the power of 4 over charge transfer energy cubed. The charge transfer energy is the energy between the 2p6 state and the 3d10 state. That's also been known since before I was born. So, okay, this is a true fact. Now, take that Hamiltonian. Just consider the spin part of the Hamiltonian. If I take a square lattice with a spin a half at each vertex, and I keep the spin part of that Hamiltonian, effective Hamiltonian, let's call it, then, you know, it's a tetragonal antiferromagnetic insulator. It's relatively, I mean, you can solve it in mean field theory as a homework problem. This is what should happen. Now, in more detail, because it's CuO2, the band structure should be a low energy 3d9 state, a high energy 3d10 state separated by many electron volts, and in between 2p6 sigma orbital of the oxygen atom separated from the upper band by energy epsilon. So that's what you would predict. Namely, because of the Coulomb interaction, it's a Mott insulator, and because of the super exchange, it should be a spin a half tetragonal antiferromagnet. Okay, So let's see. Do this. And that's exactly what it is. Neutron scattering shows that the parent state of the cuprates is a spin a half, high energy, tetragonal antiferromagnet, precisely as you would expect. And the thing you should deduce from this is that the basic super exchange idea for the strength of the spin-spin interaction on the copper sites is correct. If there are no holes in the system, what you would predict from a simple theory is precisely what you detect in a neutron scattering experiment. So spin-a-half antiferromagnetic super exchange is the mechanism of the parent state of the cuprates. All right, now look at my orbital configuration. There's four electrons, two in the copper, one in each copper atom, and two in the oxygen, 2p6 orbital. Now, what happens if you hold up, you take away one electron from the oxygen atom, like this? Well, empirically, you end up in a different universe. You only have to take away a few percent of the electrons on the oxygen atoms before the spin-a-half antiferromagnet disappears. And a new state appears, the pseudogap state. We don't know what it is. And very quickly, high-temperature superconductivity appears when you take away roughly 15, 17% of the electrons on the oxygen atoms. Now, it's not plausible, and with modern theory, as I'll show you, it's pretty clear that taking away a few electrons on the oxygen atoms doesn't actually change the band structure. They're still a 3D9 band. They're still a 3D10 band at higher energies. They're still a 2P6 band. All the oxygen orbitals are still there. And then there's some additional states which are produced by introducing the holes into the system. I just call them the hole-doped band. And furthermore, you end up with an extremely robust superconductor. So there must be pairs. And we know that they're singlet pairs from a variety of different experiments. So my cartoon is the antiferromagnetic insulator disappears and it gets replaced by a gas of singlet pairs. So Phil Anderson, so after cuprates were discovered in late 1985, by 1986, Phil Anderson had proposed that the mechanism for the formation of those pairs is the super exchange mechanism of the charge transfer transition metal oxide insulator. So essentially, and you know, if you read his famous paper, it's a work of genius, but it's not an analytic solution to this problem. He basically guessed that super exchange is the cause of why the strong electron pairs are formed. So that's what I show here in the top right-hand corner. His guess is that, and the super exchange, as I showed you, is controlled by the charge transfer energy. So he guessed that the charge transfer energy gap would control the amplitude of the Cooper pair. Okay, so here is Anderson's original paper. And in the same year, there's a beautiful paper by Vic Emery, which I'm going to talk about. And Anderson really wasn't interested in the oxygen atoms. But for anyone who has ever worked on these materials, it's very difficult to understand them if you ignore the oxygen atoms. Vic Emery's Hamiltonian takes both oxygen and copper on an equal basis. Starting at that time, there have been many, many, many famous papers which argue that super exchange is the pairing mechanism of copper oxide high temperature superconductivity. But here's the interesting thing. So here, if I bring this up to date by 2001, 2002, when I was joining this field, it was already fairly well accepted that this must be true. But here we are, 2021, 2022, people are still writing theory papers on this problem, where they use the most sophisticated numerical theories available now to try to solve the Hamiltonian to find out if charge transfer super exchange is the mechanism of high TC. And at a level of theory, they usually agree with each other that it is. So why are they still working on this problem 40 years later? And I mean, why am I still working on this problem 20 years later? So the reason is that at the level of empirical proof, this is an unresolved question. So if you believe, and perhaps some colleagues at Perimeter might believe, that the beauty and elegance of a theory is sufficient to prove that something is correct, well, then it has long been proved that charge transfer super exchange is the mechanism of high temperature superconductivity. But if you have a more Baconian view of physics where empirical facts are required, this is unresolved. No one has ever tried and been able to determine what's the relationship between the charge transfer energy gap and the amplitude of the electron pair wave function. That's why we're here this evening. Okay, now let's talk about Vic Emery. So unfortunately, Emery died as a relatively young man. But before he did, he introduced a Hamiltonian for these compounds, which takes both the d orbitals on the copper atom and the p orbitals of the oxygen atom into account on an equal basis. So this is hopping between any orbital and any other orbital, the first term. Second term is the energy of any orbital, either d or p. And the third term is the Coulomb no double occupancy, the Mott-Hubbard term on the copper side. So if you take, so that Hamiltonian is completely unsolvable, even today, you know, for a crystalline material. If you try to solve that problem analytically, it cannot be solved. So what's used is dynamical mean field theory, which is an approximation, but a very powerful approximation. So, and this was introduced by Antoine Georges and Gaby Cotillard about a little bit more than 20 years ago. So their scheme is the following. You take the real Hamiltonian, you take this Hamiltonian in the red box, but instead of taking it for the whole crystal, you just take it for a few sites. And most of the work today, we're going to be talking about four coppers and eight oxygens, so a total of 12 atomic sites. Each copper has two orbitals, so a total of 16 orbitals. So you take that accurate Hamiltonian and you embed it in an effective medium. Let's just say you start with a metal. And then you solve for what's the response of this accurate Hamiltonian in the presence of the eigenstates of that metal. Find the Green's function, find the self-energy, update the Green's function, including the self-energy for that medium, and then deduce from that after solving the impurity problem. So you solve the problem of what are the eigenstates of this impurity embedded in the medium. Then you update the Green's function for the cluster you're trying to solve. And then you compare that Green's function with the Green's function you started with for the effective medium. And if they're not the same, then you go through the next iteration. And so on and so on and so on. And you go around an enormous number of times, as far as I can tell, until if the system converges, which it doesn't always do, but if it converges, then the Green's functions for the effective medium become consistent with Green's functions for your accurate Hamiltonian impurity. So specifically for CO2, the problem, the theories that we have been following use four coppers and eight oxygens. They introduce an effective medium, solve for this object in the black box as an impurity, find the Green's functions, then update the Green's functions of the material from the Green's functions of the impurity, compare with the initial Green's functions, and if they don't agree, they keep iterating until if and when they converge, then they conclude. They have a dynamical mean field theory solution of the problem because the description of the medium is the same as the description of the impurity that you started with. That's the essential strategic structure of cluster DMFT. Okay. If you start with Emery's Hamiltonian for CO2 and you solve this problem, and if it converges, now you have powerful new information. You know the Green's functions. So, for example, what you could do is calculate is the average of this anomalous expectation value, pairs of particles, spin up, spin down, at adjacent sites, CJ. Normally in a metal, that would be zero. But in this solution, is it not zero? If it turns out to be not zero, then you say high TC superconductivity has appeared from Emery's Hamiltonian through DMFT. Okay, and that's where the experimentalists get traction on this problem. And for those of you who are used to BCS theory, you say, well, okay, what is the mechanism of ITC? That's actually an ill-posed question. There is no field of fluctuating bosons coupling to fermions here. That's not the issue. You have exchange interactions, and they produce pairs, and the pairs condense. That's the mechanism in this theory. You can ask, if you solve this Hamiltonian, is the density of states as a function of energy, the band structure in the solution, consistent with what you would expect? And it is. So on the bottom right-hand side here, we have a solution from André-Marie Tremblay's group at Sherbrooke, where they calculate density of states of the lower Hubbard band, of the oxygen band, of the hole-doped band, the gap between the hole-doped band and the upper Hubbard band, which is called the charge transfer gap. And it's essentially what we would expect from, you know, a 1980s hand-waving argument about what should happen. But now it's an accurate DMFT solution of a cluster with 16 orbitals. And you can see from the date, the numerical power to achieve this has only become available in the last year or two. That's why there's suddenly a lot of traction on this problem. Okay, so now with these DMFT solutions, there is actually, in theory, wide acceptance that charge transfer governed super exchange is the mechanism of high temperature superconductivity. If you have a theory workshop, probably most of the colleagues will agree that this is a solved problem. Among the things that can be predicted are the following thing, which is important to the experimentalists. In theory, you know, in a given material, the charge transfer energy, the energy splitting between 2p6 and 3d10 is a fixed property of the material, in a real material. But in a theory, you can dial that number. So the theorist can adjust the charge transfer energy and find out what does it do to the pair wave function. This is like the amplitude of the pair wave function. And this was originally done by Weber, Cotillard, and Howell in 2012 for lanthanum cuprate. They calculated what happens to the amplitude of the pair wave function as a function of the charge transfer splitting between oxygen and copper. And most recently, the colleagues in Sherbrooke calculated the equivalent thing, but for bisco. And that's important because bismuth, strontium, calcium, copper oxide is a material that we need to work with to solve this problem. So they predict what happens to the amplitude of the pair wave function as you change the energy splitting between these two orbitals. It's actually, you know, at the level of chemistry, it's a fairly simple idea, although the calculations are amazingly sophisticated. Okay, so these colleagues predict that And so this is just a number. We normalize by the value of the pair wave function amplitude at the natural parameters for that compound. So then we can, from these theory papers, we can say rate of change of normalized pair wave function with charge transfer energy should go as about -5 per electron volt in bisco if charge transfer super exchange is the mechanism of high TC, and a different number for lanthanum cuprate from the original Weber paper. Now, this function here, the expectation value of two fermionic operators, is a complex field. And poor experimentalists throughout our universe can't measure complex fields. We have to measure real numbers. So what we actually measure is the amplitude of this number squared. The amplitude squared of the pair wave function is the number density of pairs. So what we'd like to measure is the rate of change of the number density, the number of pairs, per, let's say, per square meter, versus the charge transfer energy and compare with theory. And in fact, from DMFT, there is a fairly clear set of predictions for what should happen. The number density of electron pairs in this type of superconductor should diminish rapidly as the charge transfer energy increases. For bismuth strontium calcium copper oxide, it would be on the lower edge of this cone. And for lanthanum cuprate, it would be on the upper edge of this cone. And most other cuprates are, from their parameters, elsewhere inside this cone. So if you're an astrophysicist, this is the cone of interest for testing this theory of high-temperature superconductivity. You should measure the density of condensed pairs as a function of the charge transfer splitting between 2p6 and 3d10, and check, does it fall inside this cone?
All right. Sorry, Seamus, so, I have a naive question. So earlier you said that the super exchange strength depends as like 1/ charge transfer gap cubed.
Yeah.
So is it obvious why this dependence of the expectation value of C up, C down should decrease linearly with?
Yeah. Okay. So this function here is quite correct. This function here is the solution for 3 atoms and 4 orbitals.
Okay.
It's not actually possible to find the analytic solution for an infinite number of coppers and an infinite number of oxygens, or at least nobody has succeeded until now. So we don't know how to generalize the solution in this red box to a crystalline environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the best we can do is to use cluster DMFT. So to first order, cluster DMFT predicts this cone. And you can see the charge transfer energy is changing by maybe 25% or something. And actually the pair wave function, the density of pairs is also changing by 20 or 30%. So if these experiments could be become more reliable and more general, probably this cone would have curved edges for the reason that you're asking about. So you can take this cone here to be the first approximation to a solution of this problem. Okay?
Okay.
All right, now, but look at this graph. You have to change the charge transfer energy, right, which is the energy difference between 2 orbitals in a piece of material. I mean, unless you're God, that's hard to do. So how would you do this? So Gabby Kotliar provided the answer to that question. He pointed out that the oxygen atom, which is above, not in the plane, but above the copper atom, is ionized. And it has a very large Coulomb field. And if you move that oxygen atom around, it changes the energy levels of the orbitals of both of copper and of oxygen in the plane. And it changes them differently. So Kotliar and his colleagues solved the problem, not of the mechanism, but of if you just move the apical oxygen atom up and down, what does it do to the electronic structure? And then other groups have subsequently done the same thing. It's now somewhat of a cottage industry, and it's widely accepted what the solution is. So if you move the apical oxygen away from the copper, that means increase this parameter delta, then it reduces the charge transfer energy. It reduces the splitting between 2p6 and 3d10. And that's been worked out actually for half a dozen different compounds now. There's the actual value of the slope, I don't know how robust that is, but the sign of the slope, everyone agrees. If you increase the apical distance, you reduce the splitting between 2p6 and 3d10. So you reduce the charge transfer energy. And typically people report the charge transfer energy, the apical distance, the slope, somewhere between 1 electron volt per angstrom and 2 electron volts per angstrom. Okay, so Kotliar's ingenious proposal is that move around the apical oxygen atom, it'll change the charge transfer splitting. And if charge transfer superexchange is the mechanism, then it'll change the superconductivity. So here's a cartoon of how that would work. So top left-hand side is a picture of our universe. There's two coppers and 1 oxygen in the plane, but there's out-of-plane oxygens and they're ionized. In plane, we're dealing with copper orbital and oxygen orbitals on an equal basis. And what we're trying to figure out is the density of condensed pairs in this environment. So if you look on the right-hand side, and now the distance between the copper atom and the apical oxygen atom we call delta. So here's a cartoon of that distance throughout the crystal, no big deal. According to our picture of the electronic structure, at each copper, there's two states, the 3D9 state at the bottom and the 3D10 state at the top. They're separated by U. And of course, there's also the oxygens in between. Oxygen and 3D10 are separated by the charge transfer energy epsilon. If you believe that that's the mechanism of high TC, then if you would change epsilon, you should change the amplitude of the pair wave function, and that should change the number density of pairs. So we just made a movie here to help you grasp what is the motivation for the project. You move around the apical oxygen atom. It alters the splitting between the orbitals, most importantly, the charge transfer energy, capital epsilon. And then within the theory, that predicts what should happen to the pair wave function and to the aerial density of electron pairs. So, you know, if you were God, you would just do this experiment and measure whether the charge transfer energy controls the condensate according to the theory originally put forward by Phil and Vic Emery. Okay. All right. But how could you do that? You need to somehow manipulate the distance between the one atom in the unit cell, the apical atom, and the planar atom. And at the same time, you need to measure the energy level difference between two orbitals in the unit cell, 2p6 and 3d10. And at the same time, you need to measure the amplitude of the pair wave function. So that's asking for a lot. And that's a reason why this has not been possible for the last 25 or 30 years. Okay. So here's the idea we came up with. In this compound, bismuth strontium calcium copper oxide, there's a natural modulation of the unit cell dimension. And it's known from X-ray scattering. So the top left-hand picture is a picture of the bismuth atoms on the top surface of this compound. You can see that it's modulating along the -1/1 direction. From X-ray, we know that along the line of maxima of displacement of the bismuth atom, below the image of the surface, there's a panel showing what happens if you travel through one period of this modulation of the crystal. So the bismuth atoms go from maximum, minimum, maximum about every 26 angstroms. But it happens that the apical distance from the apical oxygen to the copper goes from minimum to maximum to minimum, while the surface displacement goes from maximum to minimum to maximum. The reason why that happens is that the unit cell dimension of CO2 is different than the unit cell dimension of BiO. So to get them to conform, you end up with this corrugation. It's like corrugated cardboard. So we know from X-rays that in one periodic cycle of this modulation, the apical distance changes from about 2.2 angstroms to about 2.5, a little bit more than 0.3 angstroms, every 26 angstroms throughout the crystal. And if you're familiar with solid-state physics, getting atoms to move around by, let's say, 0.3 angstroms in the unit cell is absolutely amazing. So this is our opportunity. We have enough resolution in our scanning tunneling microscope that we can see every bismuth atom. Underneath every bismuth atom is the apical oxygen atom. Underneath every apical oxygen is the copper atom. So we have geometrical information that really tells us where every orbital is in this picture. The top left-hand part of the right-hand picture is an experimental image of where the bismuths are. And the bottom part of that picture is an image of where we know the orbitals are in the CO2 plane. So essentially, we know where every oxygen is and where every copper is in the experiment. Okay. Since we know throughout in one modulation how big is the change in the apical distance, that means we know everywhere in this picture what's happening to the apical distance from location to location. So the next thing we have to do is measure the energy level, the energy level splitting between the 2p6 and the 3d10 state. And With tunneling spectroscopy, that's actually possible. We have done it ourselves, and other groups like Yayu Wang's group have also done it. There's a very steep rise in the density of states at the top of the 2P6 band, and there's a very steep rise in the density of states at the bottom of the 3D10 band, and we can measure the energy difference between them by measuring the differential tunneling conductance as a function of voltage. And this graph here looks kind of innocent, the top right-hand one, but it's logarithmic tunneling conductance. So what's actually happening is that the two bands just take off like a rocket on each side, and it's rather easy to tell what's the energy level splitting between one side and the other. We assign that number, as do other authors, to be the charge transfer energy. And this is not crazy. Charge transfer energy is known from optical experiments, from tunneling experiments, from photo emission experiments, to be about 1.2 electron volts. And that's also what we find in our studies. Okay, so that's how we would measure the energy level difference between the 2P6 and the 3D10 band. And last but not least, we need to measure the amplitude of the pair wave function. And to do that, we use scanning Josephson tunneling microscopy. That's a situation where you take a superconducting tip, the BISCO sample is superconducting, so you measure the Josephson current. Now, the Josephson current from the Ambegaw-Karr-Baratov equation, the Josephson critical current multiplied by the normal junction resistance of this Josephson junction is proportional to the product of the two order parameters, which is the product of the square root of the two densities of pairs, one in the tip, NT, and the other in the sample, MP. So we assume the number of pairs in the tip is constant. So that means if we square the Josephson critical current multiplied by the Josephson, by the junction resistance squared, that number should be proportional to the number of pairs in the material under the tip. That's how we want to visualize the electron pair density, by measuring the Josephson current from a superconducting STM tip. Now, when you work through the equations, as described here, this can never work, because if you only have one atom on the end of the tip, the Josephson current is tiny, the Josephson energy is tiny, you have to work at microkelvins to do this experiment. So it doesn't work. However, there is a solution. We know the equation of motion for the quantum phase difference between the tip and the sample. And if it's diffusing slowly, we know the potential as a function of quantum phase difference. If you average over diffusive motion in that potential, and if the average is not zero, then there is still a pair current. A current of electron pairs, I, travels through this junction, but as a function of voltage across the junction. There's no current at zero voltage the way there is in a perfect Josephson effect, but there is a pair current at finite voltage, VC. And the theory for that has been worked out. So we know that the maximum of this diffusive pair current is related to the Josephson critical current squared. And if we take a derivative of the current with respect to voltage, then we know that the zero bias, and this is nothing to do with Majorana's, this is the zero bias conductance of pairs. The zero bias conductance of pairs is related to the maximum current, which is related to the Josephson current squared. So bottom line, in principle, you could visualize the number density of condensed electron pairs by imaging the maximum of the electron pair current multiplied by the junction resistance squared, and imaging that as a function of location, R. Okay, we introduced that technique about 5 years ago. In order to do it for cuprates, we actually need a cuprate tip, so we pick up a little piece of cuprate material, but we can arrange it so that we don't lose any resolution. We can see the surface quite clearly with atomic resolution, but yet we know the tip is a high TC superconducting tip. When we push the tip in towards the surface, that's decreasing junction resistance, as shown on the right, then we see a new current appearing. But now look at the axis, the horizontal axis is microvolts. So this is not single electron tunneling, it's pair tunneling at microvolt voltages. And we can measure the maximum of that pair tunneling as a function of location multiplied by the junction resistance squared. Best case scenario, the junction resistance is constant. So here's a result of such an image. Right-hand side is a topograph. Left-hand side is an image of the Josephson current tunneling into this high temperature superconductor. Actually, that left-hand image is probably the first image ever made of a pair condensate in a superconductor. We discovered that it's a pair density wave, but that's not relevant for today's discussion. Okay. In general, this technique for using superconducting tip, measuring the Josephson critical current and imaging it in space is now an accelerating new field of condensed matter physics. You can visualize the many-body quantum condensate of electron pairs by using scan Josephson tunneling microscopy. Okay, cool. Now let's do our experiment. We want to alter the apical distance between the oxygen atom above the copper, find out what happens to the charge transfer splitting between the 2p6 and the 3d9 state, simultaneously find out what happens to the amplitude of the pair wave function. So this is our environment. The crystal is modulating. If you look at the bottom right-hand image, you see that the unit cell dimension is modulating. The apical distance, red is the apical oxygen atom and blue is the copper atom. So the apical distance is modulating from a minimum about 0.3 angstroms to a maximum about 14 angstroms away and back down to a minimum again about 27 and a bit angstroms away. And this modulation we can detect everywhere in the crystal, because we can see where the apical, we can see where the bismuth atoms are, and they're above the apical oxygen atoms. Okay, so now let's, you know, grind through this project. You image the surface. It has a certain periodic modulation called the supermodulation. That's the unit cell dimension modulating for the reason I told you. You measure that modulation and extract its phase. Not quantum phase, just spatial phase, cosine phi of r. If there was no disorder, it would just be cosine q vector dot r, and this would be a perfectly smooth image. But there is disorder, as you can see in the raw experiment. So we measure this spatial phase as a function of location. And then from the X-ray data, that tells us the apical distance as a function of location. So that experiment you see here is with a non-superconducting tip designed to do high voltage experiments. We discovered how to do the same thing with a superconducting tip. So the bottom left-hand image is an image of the topograph with a superconducting tip. The middle image is an image on to the right of it is an image of the phase of the modulation we can all see on the bottom left-hand image. And to the right of that is an image of the apical distance we deduce by using X-ray scattering from our image of the surface. So we believe we know what is the distance between the apical oxygen atom and the copper atom everywhere in the experiment on the top left-hand side and in the experiment on the bottom left-hand side. That's the first step. Second step is we're going to image the energy gap between the 2p6 state and the 3d9 state. So just to show you that, you see there's a red dashed, so on the left-hand side is a real experimental surface. The red dashed line, I'm going to show you the data along that line. What I'm going to show you is the density of states as a function of voltage. That's the right-hand panel. So density of states is a color scale, voltage is along the horizontal axis, and the vertical axis is distance along this dashed line. And what you can see is that the density of states is modulating very, very strongly between a point where there's a large energy gap between the top of the lower band, it's actually at pi over 2 in this image, and there's a small energy gap between the top of the lower band and the upper band, it's at pi. We find very little modulation in the upper band, which is an interesting fact, which remains to be explained. But the energy difference between the lower band and the upper band is modulating very, very strongly. We were delighted to discover this. Similarly, now it's important to say this is a different experiment. We take a superconducting tip and a different crystal. We image the surface so we can see where the modulation is. And now we measure the Josephson current as a function of distance and ask, well, does the Josephson current modulate with the crystal periodic modulation of the unit cell? And the bottom right-hand panel here shows that the answer is yes. The Josephson current modulates with the same periodicity of the crystal. So, you know, this isn't crazy. you're altering the unit cell dimension of the crystal by, I don't know, 10% or more, 12%. In doing so, you're altering the energy splitting between the 2P6 state and the 3D9 state, the 3D10 state of the copper. And at the same time, the bottom right-hand image shows that you're altering the amplitude of the electron pair wave function with the same periodicity. We were thrilled to see the data shown on this page. It shows that the 2 degrees of freedom are modulated by the unit cell dimension in this compound. All right, so now let me summarize. So we know the spatial phase at every location, and we know the charge transfer energy at every location. So we can plot the charge transfer energy versus the phase of the modulation everywhere in the field of view, average over the whole field of view. We get a very nice signal. Charge transfer energy changes from a bit above 1 volt to a bit above 1.3 volts every 26 angstroms. That's not crazy. Similarly, we can measure the Josephson critical current as a function of location. We know the phase at every location, so we can plot. Here, actually plotted the zero bias conductance times the junction resistance squared, but it's the same thing. It's the condensate amplitude everywhere in the field of view. Then average over all pixels, we get a very nice map of what happens to the condensate amplitude as a function of the phase of the crystal modulation. All right, here is the Rosetta Stone of this whole project. We can see where the surface atoms are. That's the top right-hand image. We can see that we know from X-ray scattering what is the displacement of the oxygen atom under each atom that we see in the surface image, at least on the average. So we know how big is the displacement as a function of one period of this modulation. So in 26 angstroms, the apical atom moves about 0.35 angstroms. As I just showed you on the previous slide, we also can measure the charge transfer energy as a function of the phase of this modulation. That's the red data. It goes from, in this experiment, above 1.1 volts down to about 0.8 volts and back up again in one cycle. And from Josephson, we can measure the amplitude of the pair wave function undergoing the same cycle. So, we can plot the two observables, charge transfer energy in red and electron pair density in blue versus deduced apical displacement. Obviously, we don't measure the apical displacement, we deduce it. And since we're taking the first harmonic of both modulations, they're both straight lines, but still, it's an interesting fact. It's been predicted for more than 30 years now, what should be the change of the charge transfer energy with the displacement of the apical oxygen atom, d epsilon, d delta. It's predicted to be about minus one electron volt per angstrom. And indeed, that's what we get. It's about minus one electron volt per angstrom in these experiments, consistent with solid state physics going back for 30 years or more. But even if you don't ascribe a particular displacement in the unit cell as the cause, without doubt, the unit cell is modulating. So what you can do is just remove the common variable and plot charge transfer, plot condensed electron pair density in blue versus charge transfer energy in red throughout our experiments. And that curve looks like this. The condensed electron pair density changes by more than 25%, while the charge transfer energy also changes by more than 25%. In this material, bismuth, strontium, calcium, copper oxide, by direct observation. Those actually are the only facts that we're here to discuss today. However, if we plot the theoretical predictions for that function, so here's the experimental facts, here's the theoretical prediction, they are in excellent agreement. They really are as expected, which I must admit came as a shock to us, but it's obviously a very pleasant shock. So let's reach a conclusion now. So the proposed mechanism for cuprate high temperature superconductivity is super exchange. That's what Anderson said. And for those of us who believe you have to take into account the oxygen atom, that means it's charge transfer super exchange, having to do with the energy splitting between the 2p6 and the 3d10 state. That's what Vic Emery, God rest his soul, would have said. It has not been possible to test this idea in the intervening more than 35 years. So what we did is in a compound where the unit cell dimension modulates by at least 15%, we measured the Josephson current as a measure of the pair wave function, Ci, Cj average, and we measured the charge transfer energy as the difference between the top of the lower band and the bottom of the upper band. They both modulate with the crystal. That fact is not a function of theory. It's an empirical fact. It's an amazing fact in and of itself. Now, the measured rate of normalized pair wave function, it's normalized by the average value, compared to the measured rate of energy splitting between the upper and lower band is shown on the graph here. This is a fact. There's little or no ambiguity about this fact. We haven't done this at other dopings, but we have repeated it at optimal doping for this, as grown doping, which is near 17%. Now, this fact takes on its consequence in the context of dynamical mean field theory solution to Emery's three-band Hamiltonian for CuO2. That solution predicts that the condensate pair wave function will occur within the cone, the yellow cone shown there, for virtually all cuprates which exist naturally at the moment. Other cuprates could be created in the future, but for the ones which exist naturally at the moment, it predicts that they should occur within this cone. And you can judge for yourself whether the empirical facts occur within that cone. At face value, we think this is a direct test and very strong evidence that charge transfer super exchange is the mechanism of cuprate high temperature superconductivity, at least in this compound, bismuth, strontium, calcium, copper oxide. The one other thing I would say to you is that if the deduction from the experiment turns out to be useful or even correct, it points very strongly in the direction of the correct theories we should use to predict new high temperature superconductors. If they're going to be based on copper and oxygen, it seems to me that we should all turn our attention to the numerical and perhaps eventually analytical solution of the three-band Emery charge transfer model of the cuprates. This project was carried out by the pandemic, during the pandemic, by the team I show here. And many of these colleagues did not get to meet each other during the range of the project. So I am extremely grateful to them for their dedicated work and for the beautiful result that they found. And thank you guys all very much.
All right. Thanks for the very amazing talk. So we have some time for questions. I guess in the tradition of our colloquium, we start with any students in the audience. All right, if not, then Tarun, go ahead.
All right.
Thank you for a very nice talk. It was very, very exciting to hear it. And I had a question. When the theory is done, then it is probably assumed that the that a doping is uniform, right? It's just a translation invariant system in DMFT, just a one unit cell. But in experiment, do we know whether that doping also doesn't change locally? And otherwise one has to kind of factor that in comparing?
Okay, that's an excellent question. We don't know empirically the answer. We can estimate, you know, using Gauss's law, how much the potential is modulating in the CuO2 plane and how strong the response of the whole density would be to that modulation. And we conclude and report in our paper that we think that that is a very small effect. But it's a very good question, and it remains to be determined for the future by some form of independent measurement exactly what's happening to the carrier density in the plane.
I see. And maybe one other related, broadly related question about if the epsilon is changing locally, it perhaps means that you're in the MOT phase, in the AFM phase, J is also changing locally. Is there some signature of that at a level of antiferromagnetic ordering locally that you can detect something about just from
well, the okay. So people have wanted to measure J locally for, you know, since before. Mm-hmm. Since I was young and before you were born, nobody knows how to do that. So what we tried to do is to get access to a degree of freedom which could be measured rather than one which couldn't be measured. Right. So, you know, in fundamentally, your question is the correct one, but nobody knows how to measure T and J bond by bond in a material. So where we had to I wouldn't say fall back. We had to use an alternative approach, which is to measure the energy level splittings, which is something available to experimentalists.
Great, thank you.
Can I ask a question?
David, how are you?
Good, hi Seamus, great talk. So I'm wondering, to what extent does this measurement of the modulation of the superfluid density require a short coherence length of the superconductivity?
Right. Good. So that's a great question. So in our studies of this compound, we conclude from looking inside the vortex core that the coherence length of this compound is actually less than 2 unit cells. So within our present understanding, the range over which this modulation occurs is actually allowed, by mean field arguments having to do with the coherence length. Obviously, if the coherence length was 100 angstroms, then nothing would happen. But the core of the vortex in these compounds has a radius of only about, at least that we see, has a radius of only about 7 angstroms, which is less than 2 unit cells. So we think that what we presented to you is physically possible.
Okay. Can I ask one more question? So I noticed in your measurements of charge transfer energy, the upper Hubbard band seemed to modulate less than the doped hole band. Is that sort of consistent with the DMFT calculations, or does that provide any additional insight into
that? Yeah, that's a great question. People were not anticipating that. So the way to think about that, as you would know better than me, is that it's actually the 2P6 state or the ionized 2P6 state of the oxygen, which is being manipulated by the apical oxygen atom. Right, the upper copper band feels it less profoundly than the intervening oxygen atom. Having to do with the absolute amplitude of these effects, no, it really was not predicted. People didn't imagine that you could reach in and determine what happened. Well, I'm sure you did, but the theorists didn't imagine that you could reach in and determine what happens to these orbitals as a function of location. And so it's not predicted. And last thing I can say is that several people have asked us to look for QPI in the upper band to see if there are delocalized eigenstates in the upper band. And we have tried hard and we don't find delocalized eigenstates in the upper band. It's really not like a gas of, it would be partially populated band of electrons. That must be true, but they appear to be extremely incoherent. So two things to say: they don't modulate very much, and they appear to be very incoherent.
Okay, great, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, I think there are no more questions. So let's all thank Seamus again for a great talk.
All right, thank you guys very much.